We are in Numbers 21. So this is starting a new section. We just finished the section. Well, no, sorry. 20 was starting a new section. But we finished the section of priests. And in 20, chapter 20 was a bad chapter because we Miriam dies, Aaron dies, and Moses and Aaron rebel. Okay, join the people in rebellion. So it's a bleak chapter in the history of Israel, where even their greatest leader rebels as well. Okay, so we ended chapter 20 with the death of Aaron, and Israel mourns 30 days for him. Remember, this is the first high priest, and he's dead, and the mantle has been passed to Eleazar, and he is the next high priest. Okay?
What's the other son?
Ithamar. Nadab and Abihu died. Phinehas, I believe, is Eleazar's son, I thought, but maybe not.
It was awesome having to walk in when I was listening to him.
Yeah.
He said he completely forgot that it was Eleazar that it was passed on to because he dies, and then the line continues with the next one.
Well, Phinehas is the son of Eleazar. Because he is the one that stabs the man and woman together at the rebellion of Peor.
Gotcha.
So I don't know it. I don't.
I haven't studied that up. So okay.
I mean, at least through Numbers, it's Eleazar. I don't know if he meets an untimely doom. But then I would think it would pass to Phinehas. I would have thought, but I don't know. I mean, I'm sure Austin heard that from Kyle, so I don't know. But
that was a while ago, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. They're getting done with Job, too. Okay. All right, Numbers 21. So this is going to be the first Israel's first victory over the Canaanites is in chapter 21. And they are preparing to enter the land. They got to get to where they won't need to be to enter the land. So that's their journey. And some battles are recorded in 21. Okay. This chapter shows that God's holiness is for the nations as well. The whole world is to be holy. And because the Canaanites have not been holy, and for their idolatry, they are going to be punished. They will be judged. Okay. So we are entering into holy war, which is dictated by God. Okay, so God is moving his plan forward. Israel is getting ready to enter the land with the second generation, which we know we still have all of Deuteronomy to get through, but Deuteronomy doesn't take a lot of time. So they're getting ready to go into the land with Joshua at their head. But Moses is still alive, so they can't go in yet. Okay. Can someone read for me Numbers 21, verses 1 through 3, just the first three verses?
Israel was coming by the way of Athraim. He fought against Israel and took some of them captive. And Israel vowed a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will indeed give this people into my hand, then I will devote their cities to destruction." And the Lord heeded the voice of Israel and gave over the Canaanites, and they devoted them and their cities to destruction. So the name of the place was called Hormah.
Okay. If you take the map I gave you last week, Brittany, you were here last week. Okay. That's this one where they go all, there's the loop-de-loop down to the, yes, thank you. It says page 33 on the bottom. Okay, so Kadesh Barnea is all the way to the left side of your map, middle left. Okay, there it says, do you see under that blue arrow that's pointed northeast, way of Atharim? Okay, and then there's going to be a dotted line up to Hormah that's in a red box. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. Well, they will. They'll go down and around. Now, okay, this is our best knowledge, and there is debate over where almost all of these places are. Okay, so we're not 100% sure, but this is what we think is possible. Okay, so these maps are not scripture. Okay, they are not inspired, but this is our best best guess of how to rebuild what Scripture tells us happened. Okay, because a lot of these places we don't know where they are. Okay, but that
no longer around.
Well,
it's been renamed.
Well, yeah, they've been renamed, and then they dig down in the dirt and find places, but it's not like a rock says, this is welcome to blah, 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 you know, Horma, village of 300, you know. We don't find, typically, right, typically we don't find that. So, right, right. So, exactly. So, it's hard, and right. Right. Territories have changed. And but there have been many times when scholars have said, oh, the Bible can't be right because it should be in this location. And we haven't found anything in this location that confirms it. And then 10 years later, oh, lo and behold, they find something and that confirms it. So we've come to the point where you should just believe the Bible, regardless of whether archaeology has found something or not, because they will in time, or it's not super important and it was there. It's just there's no markings or words that tell us that it was there. Okay. So that's where we are right now, that dotted line up to Horma.
Are these from your maps?
This is from Bill Schlegel.
Yeah.
Yep.
So these are the maps that these kids used in Israel.
Yeah, I was of the old school where I had to make my own. Kyle, they got given this book with all the work done.
I thought they had to do a whole work thing in a map before they got there. There was colored pencils.
Yeah, I did. I don't know if they did.
Yeah, they did.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah, it was a big deal because I was looking for brown pencils.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, anyways. All right, so they're going to have their first battle. So, verse 21. Verse 1 of chapter 21, when the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming by the way of Atharim, then he fought against Israel and took some of them captive. Okay? So, the Negev, if you look just north of Horma, it says Negev. Negev is just the southern wasteland desert of Israel. Okay? As you can see, the middle top says the Sea of Arava, or the Salt Sea. That's the Dead Sea. Okay, it is just wasteland there. There are different oases where there's water, but most of the time there's not water. So that is the Negev. Okay, if you go to Israel today, in the Negev there is a reconstruction of the tabernacle, and Ben-Gurion lived, retired, if you know who he was, big in Israel's history, modern Israel's history. He retired into the Negev. Anyway, so that's where that is. So after mourning 30 days for Aaron, Israel sets out to go around Edom. If you remember, they asked Edom if they could go through their land, and they said, no way, not doing it. And so they have to go around. Okay, so they're starting on that journey. Well, I guess Arad heard that they were coming kind of his way and got scared, and he responds, and he goes and he actually attacks and captures some of them. Right? It says he fought against Israel and took some of them captive. So it's possible that they're journeying around here, right? He sends a raiding party, captures some of them, and so then that makes them go up and attack, right? Because they got to go rescue their people. So that would make more sense of why they would kind of go out of their way and then come back to keep the journeying around. Okay? That's just my best guess. But because it says he captured some of them. And in our view of maps, this is a long distance. It's not. Okay. Let's see. Hebron. Do you see Hebron up here? Okay. By the sea, by the Dead Sea. Hebron to Horma is 17 miles. Okay. So it's not, these are not huge distances. Israel is very small. Okay. So approximately 17 miles. So that would be, you know, from the way of Atharim to Horma is probably another 17, 20 miles. It's not like it's huge amounts of distances. You know, an army could probably march it in a day, you know, so it's not like we're talking days and days of travel. Verse 2, so Israel made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. The Lord heard the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them in their cities. Thus the name of the place was called Horma. Okay, the loss of the people, the captives, make the Israelites cry out to God. Okay, this is actually a correct response, right? Instead of complaining or turning tail and running and saying, we're so afraid. Look, God, see, they're going to conquer us all, right? Instead, they cry out to God and they make a vow. God, if you give us back our people that were captive, we will destroy the cities of the Canaanite king. Okay? Can we go to Deuteronomy 7? Can someone read Deuteronomy 7, verse 1 to 4 for me?
When the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites and the
Girgashites?
Yeah, whatever. And the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And the Hivites and Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you. And when the Lord your God delivers them before you and you defeat them, then you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no
covenant.
Covenant. Seven, you said?
Through verse four.
Oh. To them and show no favor to them. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons. Nor shall you take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you.
Okay, so this is what Moses is telling the second generation when they enter the land, right? They are to utterly destroy everyone. This is holy war, okay? And the Canaanites are being judged for that idolatry. If you remember, when God gives Abraham the land, he says, I'm going to give you this land, but you don't get it yet because the sin of the Canaanites is not full. So the Canaanites have had their time and now is judgment time. Just like when God brings Babylon and Assyria in to wipe out Israel, right? To take them into captivity. It's because it's time for Israel to be judged in Judea or Judah. This is the judgment of God on the Canaanites. That is why it is okay to utterly destroy them. Okay? All are to be holy, even the Canaanites. Now they have not, so they're going to receive judgment. Okay? So we see already that the new generation is making better choices. Doesn't make them perfect. They certainly have their times of sin that we're going to see really quickly. And the whole first generation might not yet be dead because they haven't entered the land yet. But this is a correct choice for them to cry out to God. Okay, so Israel is beginning to turn, beginning to make better choices, beginning to be the nation that God wants them to be. Okay, and I've said before, the generation that enters the promised land under Joshua is one of the best generations Israel ever has. Okay, so this is about as good as it gets. Okay, God hears and grants them with a resounding victory. Okay, it says, thus the name of the place was called Hormah. Can someone read for me Numbers 14, verse 45?
The Amalekites? Yeah, Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and struck them and down as far as Hormah.
Okay, so if you remember, this is when Israel first goes into the land, and they say, we can't go into the land, there's giants in the land. And God says, fine, you're not going to go in the land, you got to go back by the way of the Red Sea. You want to go back to Egypt, head back that direction. And they say, and that you're going to die. You're going to be judged by the first generation, you are all going to die in the wilderness. Israel says, just kidding, we'll go into the land. Moses says, nope, God's not going to go with you. They say, we don't care, and they go in anyway, right? And then they die. Yes, the Amalekites and the Canaanites struck them down and beat them as far as Hormah. Now we're in Numbers 21, and where do they have their first victory? At Hormah. So God is gracious. And where they were defeated 40 years earlier, now God grants them their first victory in the land. Because this is part of the promised land. This is part of the land that they're going to get. Okay, now they're not entering it really to conquer it yet, but this is part of the promised land. Okay?
Do you think, or have you ever heard anybody speak?
speak about the fact that when God spoke all through the New Testament to people about getting rid of all.
You mean Old Testament?
Old Testament.
Yes.
Getting rid of everyone.
Yes.
That there's something to be said for that, how we handle wars and stuff now, that that would maybe set a precedent. I mean, I'm thinking basically of Middle East wars and how we are so careful to send one, you know, bomb down a chimney to get
right.
one guy instead of taking
wiping out everyone.
The whole situation, because the ones will obviously, the way God did this was because
right.
the evil was going to keep rising up.
Right. The you difference, know? I would say, is this is God declaring that you wipe out an entire nation. Now we have wicked governments,
right.
no matter how good or righteous their intentions, they are still evil men, right, at the heart. Yes, some may be better than others, but making decisions about war, not being directly communicated by God. So I see. So, I mean, it's like World War II, right, and us dropping the atom bombs on Japan.
Right.
I listened to a podcast recently. The Japanese general admitted that if the U.S. had not dropped those, I mean, America had to drop two. We dropped one and Japan still didn't surrender. It wasn't until after the second one was dropped that they surrendered. And the Japanese general said, if you had not dropped those, Japan would be no more, because we would have fought to the last child. And if you read the book Unbroken, they were arming children. They were, because it is shameful in their culture to surrender. You just don't. You just die. And so even their general said, dropping of those atom bombs saved lives. And you get people who argue, like, how dare America have killed the civilians in those cities, whatever. But I think because we don't have a direct revelation from God, go wipe out the entire, you know, Afghanistan people, right, or whatever it is, that it is a different category of war, because these are sinful war. I mean, and it's hard, even Germany, right, during World War II, you read certain books and it's not all the German people supported Hitler, you know, so it wasn't Germany as a whole. Now, from God's point of view, are we all wicked and have rejected God? And so in that sense, we all deserve to die. You know, nations deserve to die. But even in their destruction of Canaan, right? Rahab was a Canaanite. She's in the line of Christ, right? She didn't get wiped out. Why? Because she helped the spies and she joined Israel as a nation. She converted. She became a Jew. So even in their destruction of Canaan, there is room for the nations to come in and join with Israel and not then be destroyed. So I would say it's two different categories of war. This one's being directly overseen by God nowadays. I mean, you've heard of just war theory. And so most Christian leaders would say the war needs to be just on, and there's, and one of the tenets of just war theory is that you don't just go and mass wipe out civilians. And I think part of that is because we don't have God telling us, you need to go wipe out the Germans, you need to go wipe out the Taliban, you need whatever. And so we distinguish between military and civilian.
It's just interesting because it's so effective.
When they do it right. When I was going to say yes if they do it, but
when
the problem is they don't. Yeah.
Well, and here, I remember we had asked Kyle because later on in Numbers, they fight against the Midianites, and Moses' wife, Zipporah, was a Midianite. And so we were like, oh, well, then that means her family would have all died, because it says they took all of them.
Right.
And then Kyle was talking about in Deuteronomy somewhere that gave the effect, I was trying to find the verse and I can't find it, but kind of the effect of if, like in this situation where Zipporah would have maybe had family, it would have maybe given allowance for them to rescue them out. But then here in 20, it says in Deuteronomy 20, 12, if If you are in war, and if it makes no peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. And then the Lord your God gives it to your hand, and you shall put all the males to the sword. But the women and the little ones, the livestock and everything else in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as plunder for yourselves. And you shall enjoy the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord God has given you. And then I think a little, maybe it's right before that, it says the women and children then would have been slaves
right.
to them.
Right. I mean, the case for, like, saving her whole family, possibly Rahab, right? She was told by the spies, hang out the red cord out of your window and gather all your family into the building, and whoever's in that building will be spared, right? So she could have, anyone who was going to listen to her, who believed that the Israelites were coming to destroy, they would be saved because they listen and obey, you know, as opposed to...
And I mean, this, like, because then even before this, it's saying, if you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it, and if they respond peaceably, then you're just to take everyone as your servant. So obviously in this case, God's not specifically saying wipe them out. He's just saying if you have to go to war with
right.
someone.
Right.
But in other cases where he's saying
wipe them out. Right. And that's the difference, is God is very much in charge and telling them specifically wipe these. I mean, because it's the, who is it? Oh, it starts with a G. That they don't consult God. They come and say, oh, we're from far away. Look, our bread is so old. Whatever. I can't remember the name of them. It starts with a G. Whatever. But they, you know, they don't consult God and they make a treaty. No, it might be the, I don't remember. It's here in Joshua. Gibeonites. It's the Gibeonites. Yes. They don't consult God, and so they make a treaty with them, and then God says, what are you doing? These were some of the people that should have been wiped out. So then instead, the Gibeonites become their servants, okay? But so God is very much in control of this war and is telling them exactly what to do, whereas today we don't. God doesn't work that way anymore. So he will again, though. He'll come again, and everything will be ordered exactly like he wants it. Yep.
And many.
Yeah.
Especially if they make it through the tribulation to get to the end and still don't.
That's on them.
Okay.
Yeah. I ain't going to be here to see that.
All right.
At least I hope not.
So after winning at Horma, right? If you look at where Horma is, it would have made sense to do what? And we just kind of talked about this last week. Exactly. Just keep going north into the promised land and conquer it that way, right? But Moses is not dead, okay? And he was not to go into the promised land, okay? And so they need to go around, and they're going to enter north of the Sea of the Dead Sea. So if you look at 3.3, 3-3 Transjordan Conquest, we're going to talk about this today. Okay, but, okay, this copy didn't turn out the greatest. Okay, do you see, it says Heshbon with a red box around it? Mm-hmm. Just a little to the left is Mount Nebo. Mm-hmm. Do you see that? Mm-hmm. That's where Moses dies. Okay, and he can look across there into the promised land. He gets to go up the mountain and look across into the promised land, and then they're going to cross over, and do you see Jericho just to the left of the Jordan River? Okay, that's where Joshua fits the Battle of Jericho. Okay, so that's the way they're going to go in. So because it's not time for them yet to go into the promised land, now they're going to have to go all the way around Edom. And so those are your other blue arrows on that other map, page 33. Okay, but this victory gives the second generation a foretaste of what the conquest of Canaan will be like. When they cry out to God, when they rely on God, what happens? They win. Victory. Okay?
I have a question about the map you just...
Yeah.
About the what?
I know these maps. Yes, yes.
It was the one that says 3-3 on the top.
Yes.
If Moses died at Mount Nebo way down here...
Yes.
Then why does it say Moses with Israel in the blue line?
Yes. So this is going to be chapter 21. They are going to conquer this entire area on the other side of the Jordan. Okay.
Does he come back?
Yes. yes, look at this map. Look at the really colorful map I gave you. Okay, the green, this is the promised land that God said he would give them. Okay, these are the borders as far as we can tell. Okay, do you see it's kind of the purplish? That's Gilead and Plateau. Yeah. This is the area that they conquer in chapter 21, and this is Transjordan. This is where Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, the half tribe of Manasseh, get their allotment. This is not part of the original promised land. If you look at the top, it says areas east of Jordan and next to the promised land, purple. So this is what we're talking about now. And we're going to see they don't go out to conquer this land. They get attacked, and so then they fight, and then they get the land. Okay, and God allows them to keep it, but this is not part of the original promised land. So they go up, and they keep fighting because they keep getting attacked, and they keep conquering, and they keep winning because God is with them, and God gives these kings over to them. Okay, but then they're going to come down to Mount Nebo because that's where Deuteronomy is going to happen.
Is that still part of Israel today?
No. This is Jordan. Jordan is down by the Dead Sea, and my geography is awful.
But wait.
One thing I'm going to learn in school with
is
Abby.
No.
No. No. Yes, and all that's green, this is not all Israel either, modern day. Okay, Israel ends just north of the Sea of Galilee. Like all that's way far north, that is not Israel anymore. Well, at Palestine has around Jerusalem, it's called the East Bank. Okay, they have a section in there that you do not go. Okay, when you're in Israel. So Israel has significantly less land. Yes.
Cool. And then Lebanon.
Sea of Chemereth is really Sea of Galilee.
Yes, there's different names for it, yes. Okay, the green is what God promised them. I think that they only even came close to getting this under David and Solomon.
Your Jordan River is your dividing line.
Yes. They do not have anything east of the Jordan River anymore. All right, does that, did that help?
Yep.
Okay.
At the top of the Red Sea, the
Okay. Okay. All right. Any other questions, verse 1 to 3? Yeah. Okay, can someone read for me verses 4 to 9?
There is no bread or water, and we detest this wretched food. We detest the food from God.
Exactly.
Detest this wretched food.
When Marion reads, we get the commentary too. No, it's fine.
And the Lord sent poisonous snakes among the people, and they bit them. So many Israelites died. Then the people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned by speaking against the Lord and against you. Intercede with the Lord so that he will take snakes away from us." Moses interceded for the people.
Does Eliezer not intercede like Aaron used to intercede? That was my question the first time I read this.
Yeah, I would say Aaron. Well, whenever it said Aaron interceded, it always says Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before the Lord. And when Aaron stands between the dead and the living, it's because Moses told him to.
He would have seen his father
Right.
doing it with Moses. So
yeah. And it's, I mean, I don't know that he didn't. It doesn't say, so we don't know. But that's a good question.
Then the Lord said to Moses, "Make a snake image and mount it on a pole. When anyone who is bitten looks at it, he will recover." So Moses made a bronze snake and mounted it on the pole. Whenever someone was bitten and he looked at the bronze snake, he recovered.
Okay. Very good. Okay. So, verse 4, they set out from Mount Hor, right, which is where Aaron died. by the way of the Red Sea. This is the second time they've had to go by the way of the Red Sea, right? Chapter 14, verse 25, when they refuse to go in the land, God says, fine, go by the way of the Red Sea, i.e. go back to Egypt, journey back that way. Okay? So that was punishment because they refused to go in the land, so they're going to wander for 40 years. Now this is they have to go by the way of the Red Sea because they got to go around Edom because Edom won't let them through. God has not given them Edom, so they are not allowed to fight Edom either because Edom are the descendants of Esau, relatives of the Israelites, so they do not fight. They're not supposed to fight them. Okay, this is the land God has given Edom. Israel has no claim to it. Okay. Israel gets impatient, which you can understand. They just won a victory at Hormah. They could have just journeyed north into the promised land. Instead, they have to go all the way around, all the way down and around. Okay, so you're moving lots of people. You've been doing this for 40 years. You're tired of it. Okay. So, but good news. This is the last recorded time they grumble about food, and it is the last recorded time that they yearn to go back to Egypt. Okay, so again, but this is the last time. Okay. Their complaint is very similar to chapter 11, verse 4 to 10, which is at Kibroth Hataava, which is when they complain that they don't have any meat. And God sends the quail and says, you're not going to eat it for a meal. You're not going to eat it for a day, a week. You're going to eat it for a whole month till it comes out of your nostrils, right? You're so sick of it. So it's very similar, right? I love how they say, for there is no food and no water. And we loathe this miserable food. So there is food. They just don't want that food. They want different food. Okay. So they're sick of manna. When it says we loathe, right? It's literally our soul loathes. So it's like they hate it to the depths of their very being. Okay, 40 years they've been. I mean, you think about it. Some kids, this is all they've eaten their whole lives, and now they're 40 years old. I mean, not necessarily solely, but the vast majority of their diet has been manna. Yep. Okay, they call it this miserable food, or yours had a different word, wretched food. Yes, worthless or contemptible. Miserable, yes, miserable food. Okay, they have food, again, just not the food they want. God has graciously provided them with manna for 40 years, and instead of focusing on God's grace and provision, they are focused on the lack of variety in their preferences. Okay, now we can understand you eat anything, even if it's your favorite food for 40 years, pretty sure you're going to be sick of it. However, what did you say?
Every 6 months.
Yeah, I don't know, but God has provided, and okay, now this isn't to say that they couldn't have met with traders along the road and traded for different food, right? It doesn't mean that they ate manna and only manna and nothing but manna for 40 years, but that probably was the staple of their diet, okay? Doesn't mean they never had anything else. I mean, they got quail for a whole month, right? Until it came out their nostrils.
But it was a punishment
for yes, it was. Yes. But the point is, instead of being grateful that God sustained them in the wilderness, I mean, we're talking about they couldn't farm, right, and grow their own food. Instead of having a heart of gratitude, they were focused on what they wanted instead of God's provision. And I think we're the same way. You know, God does provide for us, but then we're dissatisfied because we want something else. We want something better. And it's a heart issue. If their hearts are right, right? Paul says, I've learned to be content. When? No matter what the situation. Even if it's the same food for 40 years, Paul can be content. Now, he didn't do that. But, right? But he says, whether well-fed or hungry, he can be content with no food, right? Whether dressed or naked, he can be content with what? Why? Because he has learned the secret. because our focus is on God. It is a heart attitude. Then we can be content even with manna for 40 years. But without a heart of contentment and gratitude towards God, then it doesn't matter what God does for us. We're never going to be content, right? No matter what good gift God gives us. Okay, but we can sympathize and understand the Israelites because it is hard to be content with the same food for 40 years.
Well, it's kind of like a daily reminder of them grumbling. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
This is what happened.
Yeah. Okay. So, verse 6, God is angry, right? This provokes God to anger and judgment. What I noticed when I read this is, when does Moses intercede for them?
After.
When did he typically intercede for them?
Before.
And when, okay, and what brought about Moses' intercession this time? They asked for it. Have they ever asked for it before? No. Moses, exactly. Moses, typically the people do something stupid, right, and grumble and complain, and it's like Moses falls on his face before the Lord because he knows what's coming, right? And now Moses' intercession doesn't necessarily stop judgment, but it does stop God from wiping out everybody, okay? This time, Moses does not intercede at the beginning. He does not intercede until the people ask him to. Okay, so God sends fiery serpents, or Marian's version said poisonous serpents, or could be burning snakes, okay? And their bite kills quickly, says many of the people of Israel died.
Is this still getting rid of the first generation?
I would think so, but I don't
say that, right. You know, this is still killing off the first generation, but they're also not
they're not in the land yet,
so
right.
Right,
and my guess would be there are still some of the old generation left alive because we're still not, you know, we still have at least months, right, before we get into the promised land. But that's not to say that none of the second generation died in this plague either. I don't think you can make that claim either. Because God never guaranteed that everybody 19 and younger will make it into the land. He just said everyone that's been counted 20 and over will not. So those are guaranteed to not enter the land, but it's not like the second generation, if they rebel, they can't die too. Okay. Okay, the burning or fiery or poisonous might refer to the sensation when the venom courses through your bloodstream, right? You might have felt like you were burning from the inside out. Okay. One of my commentators said, I mean, people are always trying to figure out what kind of snake this was. I don't know that's really relevant. But apparently there's a viper called the carpet viper that is native to Africa and the Middle East, and it is the most highly poisonous viper that is native to the land. Okay, and
it's funny, right? It's a snake.
Yeah.
Going back to Eden, Garden of Eden.
Yep, and the snake. Yep, mm-hmm. yep. Okay. Verse 7, so the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned. This is a big deal. Okay? This is proof that the nation of Israel is changing. Okay? They complained, they sinned. But did the first generation ever say this when they complained and God punished them? They did not admit their sin. It seems like here Israel repents. Okay, so even in their grumbling and complaining and subsequent judgment, the second generation seems to do better, okay, than the first. God is molding the nation into what he wants them to be. Okay, so they confess that they have sinned and they ask Moses to intercede. Okay, instead of Moses just interceding on his own accord. They know from past experience that God listens to Moses. Or at least they should, right? Because there should be no nation of Israel if Moses did not intercede. Okay. Verse 8. So, okay, end of verse 7, Moses does intercede for them. Verse 8, then the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a standard, and it shall come about that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, will live. Okay? So God listens to Moses, like he always does, and provides a way out. Okay, Moses was to make a replica of the snake and set it on a pole, and it was to be made of copper. Or bronze. A lot of our translations say bronze, which is a copper alloy. Okay. Okay, so Moses is to make this serpent, put it on a pole, and then anyone who looks at it, that word for look, is carries with it the idea of to see with belief and understanding. This was the same word that is used back in chapter 17 when Aaron's rod buds, right? And bears blossoms and ripe almonds. And it says in verse 11, verse 19, Moses then brought out all the rods from the presence of the Lord to all the sons of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod. And we said that when we talked about that, they look and they get it, right? It's only Aaron's rod. He is the only one that can be high priest. The rest of us can't. So that's the same idea here. When you looked at the snake, you had to have belief and understanding, right? Yes.
What about the first generation? If they're supposed to die and they right. looked on the serpent, were they?
Well, if there were, then they would have still lived. That just that means they're going to die pretty later on. Yeah. Right, because there is no differentiation here. Only of the second generation can you survive. But God's also in control of all of that, and we know that those who are of the first generation. Yes, I would say most of them would have been dead. Well, yeah, Moses knows he's going to die before he gets there.
I mean, that's kind of like, wow, that's something we've never had to deal with.
Right.
Knowing. I wonder what that did in the camp as far
for
as
morale.
Discussion.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we have a lot of discussion about a pandemic and that stuff. I mean, I can't imagine. This is death and it's imminent. And you're not going to make it.
You know, your 40 years is your longest.
You know, you keep kind of, okay, well, the snakes didn't get us. Maybe we're going to, you know.
Right. Did they truly believe what God said? I mean, I'm sure as time went on, seeing them start to fall away. But maybe in the beginning, did they really believe it?
And what if you're like at the very last 10 people? You know. That's crazy.
Yeah.
They see the promised land gate, and they're like, oh, boy.
That's a person, but it doesn't matter. At that point, might as well go live your life. God's going to kill you. You're not going to make it, so you might as well enjoy the time you got. Yeah. No, they knew because God told them that, and that's when they said, "Oh, just kidding. We'll go into the land," right at the beginning, because He said, "You're going to wander for 40 years, and you're going to all." You said it was better to die in the wilderness. You're going to get what you want. You're going to die in the wilderness. And then that's when they were like, just kidding. Moses says, not a good idea. And they do it anyway.
It's crazy when you really stop and think about it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure depending on some personalities, some were like the doom and gloom Eeyore on
the
die today. Others were like, well, we'll see.
Run from the snakes. Anything but snakes.
I don't know. That doesn't say.
No.
I mean, it does say many of the people of Israel died, but we don't know how many is. So.
Yeah, there's no number with this one.
Nope. Okay. At the end of verse 8, it says, when he looks at it, he will live. Okay. Let's go to Numbers 14. I'll read it. Verse 38. Numbers 14, verse 38. This is, again, when Israel is refusing to go into the land the first time. It says, but Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, will remained alive out of those men who went to spy out the land. Okay, so this is Joshua and Caleb. They're the only ones that survived. They live. That's the same idea. Joshua and Caleb live because of their obedience. If you get bit and you look at the snake, you will live because you have done what you were supposed to do. Okay. God is refining the nation and making them into who they should be. They need to respond in obedience. Also, they had to look after they were bitten, okay? It's not like if they just stared at the pole, they would never get bitten by the snake. It wasn't a magic charm that's going to ward off the snakes, okay? Once they were bitten, right, then they have to look at the snake, and then they will live, okay? You had to believe, look, then live. Okay, if you don't, you're going to die. Let's go to John 3. Can someone read for me John 3, 14 to 16? John John 3, 14 through 16.
Just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, so that everyone who believes in him will have eternal life. For God so loved the world in this way, he gave his one and only Son, so that everyone who believes in him will not perish, but have eternal life.
Okay, so John makes the parallel. Well, I guess this is Jesus. Jesus makes the parallel, right? Recorded by John when he's talking to Nicodemus, that the snake up on the pole is a picture of Christ. Okay, so because the snake was lifted up in the wilderness, it's a picture of how Jesus is going to be lifted up on the cross. People had to look at the snake, believe, and live. Same was us. Men, this is a quote from one of my commentaries, men dying in sin are saved by the dead body of a man suspended on the cross. Now, we're not saved just by his dead body, also by his resurrection, right? But it's the idea here of the snake up on a pole is the same as Jesus on the cross. Okay. And fun tidbit, our sign for medical people today is what?
The
snake on the pole. Yeah, right. Well, where else does it come from? I mean, it doesn't come from anywhere, but that's where it is. Yes, it's not necessarily this specific one where it, I think it's in Judges.
Okay,
I think.
Like, he was having a hard time. Like, why did they give him, why did God give them this pole when we turn it into an idol? Like, I realize it has the parallel.
Right. Right.
But
hey, Kyle, where does the snake on the pole become an idol?
In Amos?
Okay, I was way wrong.
So I think that question's easier than where. I just can't remember where. Because like
here, it's in 2 Kings 18, Hezekiah. It says he removed the high places and broke
the
pillars and cut down the Asherah. And he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the people of Israel had made offerings to it. It was called Nehushtan. So this is Hezekiah. So I guess it is that exact same snake.
Yeah, right. Yep.
Gotta love Google.
Because they have a bunch of idols.
Yeah. It's fine. Sweetie, you don't have to know everything. It's okay.
But no, I think they gave them the snake because of the symbolism, right? So part of what becomes, for the lack of a better term, consistent in New Testament theology is that we have to have the humility to look upon the specific transgression, the specific sin, face it in the mirror, don't deny it, right? You admit your sin, you confess your sin, right? And so that's part of the idea there in Numbers, is that they look upon this snake, right? They have to face their own, in this sense, it's like the consequence of their sin, but what they're having to deal with is the reality that, hey, that's you. So don't deny it, right? Because it's symbolizing your impurity. So if you're going to come to me on the basis of repentance, and you're not going to say that you're impure, you're a big fat liar, because that's what that snake is telling you. Right? The reason why that judgment came to you is because of I'm getting two events confused.
They grumble because of the food.
They grumble.
And because they're having to go around eat them.
Yeah, I'm thinking of number 25 and 21. Right? So yeah, you have to face the fact that you are grumblers, that you're complainers, that you don't trust me, and you're going to have to admit that. And, you know, so it's kind of like, here you go. It's kind of like this idea. The way up
is the way down.
Right? And that would make sense because Jesus says those kind of statements all the time. Mm-hmm. Right? He who exalts himself will be humbled. You know, to the one who thinks he has this, even that will be taken away from him. Right? So the idea of being responsible. But, so does that make sense? Right?
Yeah.
But then man, the Israelites take something that God gave them for their salvation and they turn it into an idol.
So why did he give them the pole to begin with? It is to look upon their sin, to realize their sin, and by seeing their sin, they see more of God's forgiveness. That would
They're supposed to see more of God's forgiveness.
Yes.
And this generation did that, but that doesn't mean that subsequent generations skew it.
God shouldn't have given them the bronze snake because they can make it into an idol. We could also say he shouldn't give you anything at all because you can make it into an idol.
Right. I
mean, the sun, the moon, anything.
Yeah.
Your hair curler. Amazing. Anyway, does that make sense?
I think so, yeah.
It's the negative aspect of your sin that they need to focus on. They can't hide from it. They have to face it. They have to admit it. And by admitting it, they get salvation.
So then when we correlated that to the cross, the Jews wouldn't have been like, oh, we saw Jesus and now we know our sin, because they all felt like he was the sinner and they put him on the cross for that.
Right, but now we, when we look at the...
Yes,
when we, right,
yes.
And so it's not going to necessarily be the Jews, it's going to be those who believe. And that, I mean, it's not the same... To be saved, you can't just look at Jesus and be saved, right? But you have to look with the eyes of faith, the believing, that he is suffering the fate of my sin.
What was that scripture in Kings again?
Second Kings 18, and I'll look it up just a second, not the verse. Second Kings 18, verse 4. And that's Hezekiah, he destroys it because it had become an idol. Okay, gotta love Google.
Well, you know, even in some religions, the cross, especially with a crucifix.
Oh, yes, has become an idol.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, people wear crosses all the time and they have no idea.
Yeah, they don't have any clue what it's for.
You know, the cross protects me or...
Yes, right.
Whatever.
Right. That's a good point. We even make the cross into an idol.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Can someone read for me verse 10 to 20 of Numbers 21?
I will. Now the sons of Israel moved out and camped in Oboth. They journeyed from Oboth and camped at Iye-Abarim in the wilderness, which is opposite Moab, to the east. From there they set out and camped in Wadi Zered. From there they journeyed and camped on the other side of the Arnon, which is in the wilderness that comes out of the border of the Amorites. For Arnon is the border of Moab, between Moab and the Amorites. Therefore it is said in the book of the wars of the Lord, Waheb and Suphah, and the wadis of the Arnon, and the slope of the wadis that extend to the site of Ar and leans to the border of Moab. From there they continued to Beer, that is well with it, that is well where
the well
where the Lord said to Moses, assemble the people that I may give them water. Then Israel sang this song, spring up, O well, sing to it, the well which the leaders sank, which the nobles of the people dug with the scepter and with their staffs. And from the wilderness they continued to Matana, and from Matana to Nahaliel, and from Nahaliel to Bamoth, and from Bamoth to the valley that is in the land of Moab at the top of Pisgah, which overlooks the wasteland.
Okay. So this is basically a recap of their journey around Edom. Okay. So if we look at our map, and we don't know where most of these places are. Okay. So they're going down all the way to the tip of the Red Sea. Then they're coming up you can see there's that Iye Abarim. It's at the very right of your map, and it has a question mark next to it. Okay, so we think maybe that's where it is. That's the whole point. We don't know where these things are. Okay? But they are journeying up past the Arnon River. If you look at that page 33 map, that's at the top right of your map. It says Arnon River just to the right of the Dead Sea. Okay, so that's what they're doing. They're going up past Moab and up past the Arnon River. Okay? Okay, so in this section, we have extracts from their travel log interspersed with fragments of old poems. And one of my commentaries says this conveys the sense of elation as the goal of their wandering comes into sight. Okay, in verse 10 to 12, four times we have moved out and camped, set out and camped, journeyed and camped. Okay, verse 10, they moved out and camped. 11, they journeyed and camped. Verse 12, they set out and camped. Verse 13, they journeyed and camped. Okay? So this just gives us the sense of their movement, and also reminds us back in chapter 9 when Israel faithfully followed God's lead. Remember, the first 10 chapters of Numbers are great. They're totally obedient. So in chapter 9, it talks about, you know, when God rose up, the cloud rose up, they moved. And when it settled down, they camped. I mean, so that's this idea. God's moving, they camp. And then they journey out, and then they camp. And then they set up, and they camp. Okay, they're following God's lead. And again, we do not know where these places are. I don't know. I mean, it's not like the cloud would have risen up and then taken off and they don't have time and then they lose the cloud. So I don't know. It says when the cloud rose up, right, then they would pack up and move. So I don't know if it would rise up and hover. However it worked, it worked. So I don't know. But
because they got their tents to tear down.
Yeah, right.
Pack up all their
stuff. And right,
you know,
right.
I don't know how much time is between them.
No, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. There's no time given. Okay. And obviously they had to tear down the tabernacle, and the priests had to do all the prep work of all the furniture before anyone else was even allowed in to do tear down. So God had to have given them time, and obviously he knows that. So, okay. Verse 14, therefore it is said in the book of the wars of the Lord. So this is the only reference in scripture to this book of the wars of the Lord. Okay, this we assume that this is a book of victory songs. Okay, verses 17 and 18, that little poem, that also might be from this book as well. Okay, this poem here in verse 14 to 15, or this song, is very confusing because the start of it has no verb in it. It's just names of places. Wahib in Sufa, wadis of Arnon, the slope of the wadis. Okay, a wadi, if you don't know, a wadi is a dry riverbed where when there's rain, a river flows through it, but a lot of times there's no rain, and so then it's just a dry riverbed. Okay, that's what a wadi is. The only place we know really in this poem is the Arnon. That's the Arnon River, which is on your map, and we actually know where that is. Okay? But it's basically, this poem is names and geographical features. Okay. So this just emphasizes the journey God is leading Israel on. Okay. The Arnon River is the northern border of Moab. And that's what it says. The wadis of the Arnon and the slope of the wadis that extends to the site of Ar and leans to the border of Moab. So it's just confirming that the Arnon River is the north border of Moab. And also, this is only an excerpt of the song. We don't get the whole thing, the whole poem or song or whatever it was. So it's just this excerpt in here.
Do they still sing these songs?
No. I mean, not that I'm aware of. I mean, we don't, this book doesn't exist anymore. The Book of the Wars of the Lord. It's not a book we have today. So it didn't get passed down. So all that we would have are these little snippets. So I would doubt it. The Psalms still get sung, but yeah. Verse 16, from there they continued to Beer, that is the well. Beer means well, okay? And here, notice it says, that is the well where the Lord said to Moses, assemble the people that I may give them water. What is God doing?
Providing.
Providing them what?
Water.
And who didn't complain? Israel. God gives them water without them complaining for it first. So see, the second generation is doing better. The old generation is passing away and the new generation is rising up. Okay, and so instead of complaining, they sing a song that celebrates the gift of water provided by Yahweh. And it looks like they actually have to dig this well. Okay, so God is providing them water, but it doesn't mean they just, you know, they actually still have to work for it. Okay, he probably told them where to dig. Because it says, which the nobles of the people dug with the scepter and with their staff. So this song might have been sung as the leaders are digging the well. Notice it is the leaders that dig the well. It celebrates, the song celebrates the gift of water provided by Yahweh and the leaders who are serving the people by digging this well. Okay. Second half, verse 18, from the wilderness they continued to Mataneh and from Mataneh to Nahil. Okay. And so forth. So it continues the itinerary of Israel's journey and they end at Pisgah, which is Mount Nebo. So let's go to Deuteronomy 34. Can someone read for me Deuteronomy 34, verse 1?
Now Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah,
which is
opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land,
Gilead
as far as Dan.
Okay, so if you look at your map, this one, not the super colorful one, but the other one, 3-3, and we looked at it already, there's Mount Nebo. This is traditional Mount Nebo, okay? And so this is probably where they were, and Pisgah was probably the highest peak or something like that. Okay, one of my commentators said, on a clear winter day from the traditional Mount Nebo, one can see where the Jordan River flows into the Dead Sea, the northern end of the Judean wilderness, and the Jericho Oasis, as well as the regions to the north on both sides of the Jordan. So from the traditional place, you could see into the Promised Land. Okay.
What was the Deuteronomy?
34:1. So that's where they are now. They are now north, just north or of the Dead Sea. Okay, that's where we end up at verse 20. Yes, Mom.
That Nebo is different from Evo, right?
Yes.
What was the other mountain there? Oh, Gerizim. Never mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's yeah.
Evo,
not yeah. Okay. Questions, verse 10 to 20. Arava, yeah, there's lots of different names. Salt Sea, Dead Sea, we call it the Dead Sea today. Yep.
Did you, when you were in the Negev, did you see Mount Nebo? Did you guys ever go there, or was it just Sinai?
No.
I'm trying to think of...
I never did. I mean, I went to Petra, so I crossed into Jordan, but that's way north. Nebo is way north of there.
Right.
Okay. So no. And you couldn't cross over there because you would have had to go through the East Bank,
right,
which we were not allowed to. So, yeah. Except my semester, there was one guy who wanted to film a Palestinian, like, interview him, and so he got special permission to go to whatever city. Shaban took him in. Is that his name? Who was the guy that changed the money?
Oh, Shaban.
Yeah, he took him in. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he was a Palestinian, but he was the one that always changed the money for our group from USD into shekels, and so he took Rob in, and he...
Yeah. Connected.
Yes.
He found a kid's wallet, Kyle's year, I think, that got stolen within about 2 or 3 hours.
Whoa!
He found it. And he was very, very good to the students.
So you change money and you don't ask too many questions.
He had, Kenny went back in the back room with him to change some money when we got stuck there, and Kenny said he had lots of money.
Yeah.
But
yes.
He was good to the kids.
Yeah.
Thank the Lord.
And he always gave you a good rate, too, of
yeah.
changing money. So that's why we always used him.
He wasn't, like, cheating you. You know, like, if you wanted $10 or something.
Well, no, because you could go to other money changers and see the rate. You're going to give me how many shekels per dollar. And so he always gave you a good rate.
That was the first place they took all these kids, and he, you know.
Right. Our first time into Jerusalem, we always went to Shaban's shop, and then we would all change our money. Yeah.
And, you know, he was making money off them.
Yeah, right.
You know,
right. So.
And you'd bring the parents and he'd make more money off us.
So it was a good business for him because every semester there's 40 new students and
yeah.
throughout the semester you change more money. And so,
yeah.
anyway. All right. Sidetrack. Can someone read for me verse 21 to 35? Oh, we don't. We're not going
to
finish.
Sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, "Let me pass through your land. We will not turn off into field or vineyard. We will not drink water from wells. We will go by the king's highway until we have passed through your border." But Sihon would not permit Israel to pass through his border, so Sihon gathered all his people and went out against Israel in the wilderness and came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. Then Israel struck him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, as far as the sons of Ammon, for the border of the sons of Ammon was Jazer. How far am I going?
Oh, end of the chapter.
Oh, Israel lived in all the cities of the Amorites in Heshbon, and in all her villages, for Heshbon was the city of Sihon, the king of Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab, and had taken all his land out of his hand as far as the Arnon. Therefore, those who use Proverbs say, "Come to Heshbon, let it be built, so let the city of Sihon be established. For a fire went forth from Heshbon, a flame from the town of Sihon. It devoured Air of Moab, the dominant heights of the Arnon. Woe to you, O Moab, you are ruined, O people of Shemash. He has given his sons as fugitives and his daughters into captivity to an Amorite king, Sihon, and we cast them down. Heshbon is ruined as far as Dimon. Then we have laid waste even to Nopa, which reaches to, oh my goodness,
Medeba.
Thus Israel lived in the land of the Amorites. Moses went to spy out Jazer, and they captured its villages and
dispossessed
the Amorites who were there. Then they turned and went up by the way of Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, went out with all his people for battle at Edrei. How do you say that?
Edrei.
But the Lord said to Moses, "Do not fear him, for I have given him into your hand and all his people in his land, and you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of Amorites, who lived at Heshbon." So they killed him and his sons and all his people until there were no remnant left him. There was no remnant left him, and they possessed the land.
Okay.
Is it Sihon?
I don't know. That doesn't matter. Okay. We're not going to get through all this because we have 5 minutes, but... So here we have two battles, okay, and two victories. So Israel, if you look at your map again, they are at the Arnon River, which if you look at 3.3, this is down here at the bottom of the river. Bottom of the river, bottom of the map, okay? So they are here between the Arnon. Is the Jabbok on here? Yes, okay. The Jabbok River is up here. Okay, do we see? It's middle of your map, Jabbok River. Between these two rivers, the Amorites live. Okay? Israel is going to cross into Israel where your number three is. Do you see that? Okay? That they're going to go across into over and conquer, start conquering Jericho. The only way to go across is if they actually enter Amorite territory. There's no other way. Okay? They have to get into Israel. This is the way God has chosen for them. So to do what God says, they got to cross Amorite territory, okay? So they are asking the Amorites, "Hey, can we go through your land?" And the language is very similar to what they asked of Edom, right? If you look at verse 22, Moses says, let me pass through your land. We will not turn off into field or vineyard. We will not drink water from wells. We will go by the king's highway until we have passed through your border. Just let us go on the road. Okay? They respond very similar to Edom. Verse 23, but Sihon would not permit Israel to pass through his border. So Sihon gathered all his people and went out against Israel in the wilderness and came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. Do we have Jahaz anywhere here? Yes. Okay. So Jahaz is your number one on your map. And notice it has a question mark by it, so we don't know exactly where it is. Okay. So that's where they meet up. I guess maybe Israel has started to march north anyways. And that's the king's highway that they are on. And so they're going to try to stay on that, but the Amorites won't let them. Okay, so that's where they fight. And notice that they fight, why? Are they trying to conquer the Amorite territory? Is that their goal? No. They just want to get to the promised land. Right, they're not going to do anything, but they fight because they are attacked. And the Amorites are not related to them. They're Canaanites.
They're finally
obeying. Yes.
Obeying God.
And they are obeying God. Okay? In Deuteronomy 2, I don't have time. Let's just go really quick. Deuteronomy 2, Moses is recounting all this, and it is more detail. 24, God is talking, and he says, arise, set out, and pass through the valley of Arnon. Look, I have given Sihon, the Amorite king of Heshbon, and his land in your hand. Begin to take possession and contend with him in battle. Okay? So God says, you're going to take it, but they don't attack first. They are attacked. Okay? Israel is attacked. Verse 26 in Deuteronomy 2, I sent messengers to Sihon. Verse 27, let me pass through your land. Verse 28, you will sell me food for money so that I may eat, and give me water for money so that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot. So Moses even says to the king, hey, if we eat any of your food, if we drink any of your water, we'll pay for it. Okay? All we want to do is pass through the land. Verse 30, but Sihon, king of Heshbon, is not willing for us to pass through this land. For the Lord your God hardened his spirit and made his heart obstinate in order to deliver him into your hand. Okay, so God, it says in Deuteronomy that God hardened Sihon's heart just like he did to Pharaoh to make an example of him. Okay, so Sihon's army encounters Israel's army at Jahaz. And Israel fights, and God grants them a great victory. It says in back to Numbers 21, verse 24, then Israel struck him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok. Okay, so that's this whole territory on your map. That's what the Amorites owned, and that's what Israel conquers, all of it. Okay, struck him with the edge of the sword means utter destruction. Okay, and just so you know, this is 45 to 50 miles. Okay, so it's a chunk of land, but it's not like huge. Okay, and the Jordan River is the western boundary, and Ammon is the eastern boundary. The Ammonites are descendants of Lot. By his daughter, remember? The Moabites and the Ammonites are descendants of Lot. So the Israel does not get the Moabite land or the Ammonite land because they are relatives. Okay, but the Amorites, they have the Arnon to the Jabbok with the Jordan River as their western border and the Ammonites as their eastern border, and they get that chunk of land. Okay? This is holy war, so they destroy everything and they take verse 25, Israel took all these cities, and Israel lived in the cities of the Amorites in Heshbon, Bon, and in all her villages. Okay? If you look at your other map, well, this is going to be, if you look, it's the Arnon River to the Jabbok River. The Arnon River is the southern border because the Moabites were before them and the Ammonites are to the west. Okay, so they get this chunk of land. Reuben is going to settle there in that specific area. In Gilead is going to be Gad, and then west of the Sea of Galilee is going to be Manasseh. that's how it's going to settle. Okay. Verse 26, for Heshbon was the city of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and had taken all his land out of his hand as far as the Arnon. So what we find out here is that the Moabites used to own that land, but the Amorite king, Sihon, this specific king, he defeated the Moabites and he took the land, and now Israel's coming and taking the land from the Amorites.